Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin on the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's most experienced active investment managers. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Capital Client Group, Inc.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Oscar winner Alicia Vikander on her new movie Firebrand, where she plays the last wife of Henry VIII. I speak with the director of the creepy new Irish horror movie and South by Southwest Audience Award-winning horror movie Oddity. And Chris Wasser's here with all the week's new movie releases. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well. I'm going to start with a plea related to movies and TV shows. And just, if you are watching a TV show or a movie on your phone or on your laptop on public transport, I beg of you, put in some headphones. I'm a regular train user, well, usually once a week, and I'm astounded by the amount of people watching stuff without headphones. It just baffles me. Like, why? How? Please, just put on headphones. I'm sorry to start with a kind of nag, but it just absolutely baffles me. So, dear listeners, if you're one of those people, Stop now. Put on headphones. Now, in happier news, on the 31st of August, so if you're listening on the radio this very day, Saturday, it's National Cinema Day. What a wonderful thing. Where 99% of the cinemas in the Republic of Ireland are participating. So you can go to any movie, on any screen, any type of seat, for €5, right? So it's just gone 6 o'clock here on the radio on Saturday evening. You can still book. You can still go. 99% of the cinemas in Ireland are participating. It was a massive success last year. If you're wondering what to do in the next few hours, why not go to the cinema and watch something for £5? Isn't that incredible? So it's National Cinema Day. Get out there and support your cinema. If you're listening to this show and a regular listener, you do already. So urge your friends to do it on National Cinema Day. I mean, go any day, but might as well go today. It's only £5. Sure, where would you be going? Where would you have it, huh? Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
Sir, it's my monkey, not hers.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that, but if I'm being honest, in the food inspection game, it doesn't really matter whose monkey it is. It's more just the monkey of it all.
Okay, look. My name is Neville Stafford, and I've had a very bad week.
My sister sold our childhood home in Andros.
Sold it right from under me.
Ouch.
Yes, but if I cause problems for her and her restaurant, I lose a moral high ground.
Oh. And you're planning on holding it over her head forever?
Yes, I am.
I like your vibe, Neville. Ma'am, I'm gonna come back next week, and as long as the kitchen is 100% monkey-free, then I won't file a report. Sound good?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I owe you one.
I'm gonna hold you to it.
Oh, yes, the great Vince Vaughn, a man who reminds me of Bill Murray in lots of ways. That is a clip from an Apple TV show called Bad Monkey. And you heard him there playing a health inspector talking to a character called Neville, who has a monkey in a kitchen of his sister's restaurant. What's going on here is that Vince Vaughn plays a detective who was recently suspended because he got into trouble with a woman who was married, and he ran her husband off a pier in a golf cart. And he's now hanging out in the Florida Keys. Eventually gets a job on his way back to being a policeman as a health food inspector in restaurants. But a body, well, not a body, a severed arm shows up off the Florida Keys, and he starts to reluctantly, but then can't help himself, get back into police work and find out who this severed arm belongs to. This is really pleasing TV from the same team behind Ted Lasso. Vince Vaughn is delightful in it. Really funny, well-written story. There's another kind of tandem story going on with that character, Neville, who's hanging out in the Bahamas. But because of this severed arm, and for reasons we won't get into now, he gets involved. This is the kind of show, I was talking to Pat Kenny about it during the week, that makes you kind of want to go on holidays because it's all very sunny, but it's a really good, funny cop drama or a kind of detective work drama. There's a love interest happening for Vince Vaughn as well. This show will make you smile. It's dropping weekly on Apple TV. I'm 4 episodes in, really, really enjoying it. Even though it's about murder, it is very funny and very pleasing and kind of a warm show in lots of ways, with some nasty characters in it as well. But it's really bringing a smile to my face. So that is Bad Monkey on Apple TV, dropping weekly. There's 4 episodes up there. Very, very enjoyable. Now, something very different is a new movie called Firebrand, which is in cinemas next Friday, the 6th of September. And in it, we're back in Tudor, England, and it's telling the story of Catherine Parr, the 6th and last, and indeed surviving wife of Henry VIII. Unpleasant man, as he's certainly portrayed in this by Jude Law. And opposite him, playing Catherine Parr, is Alicia Vikander. She's named the regent while Henry's away fighting overseas. And Catherine had done everything she can to push for a new future based on kind of radical Protestant beliefs. With an increasingly ailing and paranoid king returning, he turns his fury on the radicals of the time and charging Catherine's childhood friend with treason and burning her at the stake. She's horrified and grieving. This is Catherine Parr, but forced to deny her friendship with this radical. And Catherine finds herself fighting for her very own survival. Some of what's going on in this movie is, you know, historical revisionism, and it's making assumptions about what might have happened. But it's also very much historically accurate, as in Catherine Parr was the last and indeed surviving wife of Henry VIII, and indeed was quite a radical herself and was attempting to steer England in a better way in any way she could. As I say, Jude Law plays Henry VIII brilliantly. He's horrible. And Alicia Vikander plays Catherine Parr with a lot of dignity and suffrage, trying to survive against this tyrant and trying to possibly usher in a new time in English life. Alicia Vikander is the Oscar-winning actress. She won an Oscar for The Danish Girl. She was in Tomb Raider. She's married to Irishman Michael Fassbender. Fascinating actress who I spoke to about Firebrand and a bit more besides earlier in the week. So Alicia, you know, it seems to me that history and indeed films and stories, now in the age we live in, we're trying to almost resurrect women's stories and bring them back to the center of the story, you know, in from the margins, because so many stories, be it them historical or fiction, are told from a man's point of view. And it seems, you know, Catherine Parr is a great example of that. Was that kind of what you guys were doing? Was that maybe the appeal of it?
I think most of us who were, you know, involved in making this film felt like this was a piece of history that we kind of, you know, couldn't believe. Not much people knew about. I mean, I felt it when I read the script the first time. I was almost embarrassed, the fact that it's interesting how history seemed to be more interested in dead women than anyone who, like, you know, accomplished the things that actually Catherine managed to do during her time. I had no clue that, you know, the wife that survived, that I maybe even knew the least about, that she had actually, like, ruled Britain for a short time, that she was the first ever woman in British history to publish under her own name. I mean, that to me is like, and I thought it was maybe me being Swedish, but I asked a lot of my British friends, no one had any clue of that. I was like, but that about her publishing in that's a pretty, like, big thing. And then I even started to think, like, how far back do I even know women who published? And then it's pretty sad, because I realized that I haven't read a lot of female voices at all going back in history. And then when I actually pulled out and I was reading her texts, preparing for it, it was quite a feeling, because I realized that it's mostly, like, male voices I've ever, like, connected with going this far back in history.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because when I watched the movie, I went back and did a very small amount of digging myself on her. And I wasn't sure if it was that she was the first queen to ever publish a book, but she was the first woman at that time. That's incredible.
First woman. Really, I mean, how, I mean, and she published, you know, very controversial and political and religious thoughts that sometimes even then went against, you know, obviously the Henry's beliefs.
Mm.
And she managed to do that openly under her name. I mean, that kind of gave me a hint of how this woman must have navigated this relationship, how she like gave him enough to feel like she did her part and she lifted him up in the way that she should. But that she also somehow managed for, you know, to gain that trust from him whilst fearing for her life on an everyday basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the reading you did. I gather, like a lot of great actors and actresses, you prepare a lot, but there was probably a lot to read in terms of history on this. I imagine you can get bogged down in that stuff if you're not careful.
I mean, you did realize quite quickly when you had a few books, you know, in front of you, and Jude, who had read even more, because when I kind of came aboard, he was already attached and he, you know, he did so much work. But it was nice because he kind of shared. He was like, yeah, you kind of don't need to read all three, he said, because it's kind of the same pillars of history. And then you realize that the historians are also just, you know, artists and poets of their own right, in the sense that they need to kind of figure out what did happen in between. And I guess that also kind of in one way kind of helped us in our version of this film, where we, you know, we make certain assumptions. And I guess one thing that I thought was nice was, and everyone would say, well, you know, recreating history. I was like, actually, what you realize when we even sat down with the historians, when we've, you know, when this story takes us one way, we actually have no clue what happened there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that is actually just something. There is no record of what happened just after his death or just leading up to his death. And I thought that, you know, that was quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's handled very well in the movie without saying what happens or anything like that. You know, Jude is opposite you and he's astonishing looking, whatever about his performance, which is great, as is yours. Mm. But he's it's Henry VIII. I mean, when he first showed up on set like that, did you get a good Lord? Because he's so big.
I mean, I give it to him, Jude. Like I kind of knew I was up for, you know, seeing a pretty remarkable transformation. I think he's proven that several times throughout his career, that he's just that kind of actor. But for sure, when you see that, it's like he said, it's like this known square shape, you know, and the kind of like monstrous kind of feet. I mean, it was a very large presence that walked on set.
Yeah,
it was in the same way that Kareem, our director, I knew she like let us have these very kind of alive 360 sets. Like having Jude walk in there with his energy was a big part of really getting a chance to kind of, for pockets of time, feel like you escaped into to another time and this story.
Yeah, I can imagine. And in terms of, I read somewhere that your own costumes and the ladies around you, it was quite intensive, and there was even back problems some people were having.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was, because I've done most centuries now, actually. Yeah.
I've done most, and the future even.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought maybe like 18th century, which has like the most, you know, strings and stuff, would be, you know, the most difficult. But I don't know what, but these were extreme. I think it's the amount of weight that your shoulders, it's quite a lot of kilos every day, and how, you know, to have these kind of square open necklines, it's a lot of pressure that needs to be like, I don't know, tied in the back. So they had to bring like osteopaths and stuff to set, because we were all like, it was interesting because we all had, at least that's, you know, when I felt like, oh, I don't want to say anything and I don't want to be weak, we all had the same pain. So it was always like between the shoulder blades, we had like a lot of, yeah, like all of us had the same issues.
Wow. You know, I also read, I think it might have been in Elle magazine, not that I read it that often, but that you get the blues. You get the blues often when you're finished with a movie, because the character you've lived with is gone. I presume you're going to get that for Catherine.
Oh, did I Did I say that?
Apparently
I don't even.
so.
It feels like it's.
Does
That's
that seem
interesting.
accurate?
Well, no, because I. That's interesting because I think I've talked about not so much with the characters. That's so interesting.
Okay.
Now it makes me want to go back and read that interview because I remember me having it. But but it's interesting. What I think I focused on when I talked about it was that it's more. It's not like sometimes I feel like a relief of leaving, like, you know, because it's quite intense, like
sure.
You're kind of, you know, the your own working relationship with your own character, and it's more like the whole experience of filmmaking is the first time I had a girlfriend who kind of came and visited early in my career, because most of my friends are not in this industry. And then, like, it's a kind of interesting working. Like, it's so intense. You're away on location. It's a bit like summer camp. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of it, you know, because you kind of work day and night. You don't really see anyone else. You, like, change in a bathroom some, you know, especially with independent filmmaking. And then it is kind of interesting that you're kind of just lifted away from all of that in kind of one day.
Yeah.
And then it's more like, I don't know if it's so much about leaving the character. Sometimes it's just like the intensity of filmmaking that I can find, you know. I think I used to have the blues because it was kind of uprooting each time. And now I think in the later years, I think, you know, I think I've started to find it quite beautiful how you can meet and work very closely with people. And, you know, and as we know, as, you know, adults, it's difficult to find time sometimes to, you know, even find time with your friends and family and people.
Sure.
And then it can be quite interesting that you get to come very close in a very creative process with people. And then you might say goodbye and you might not see them for a few years, but then sometimes too, you end up on a set like with Jude. I mean, we worked, it was one of my first films. And in one way, it's interesting when then 10 years have passed and you're like, oh, here we are again.
Yeah.
And you're
going
to do something interesting together.
In circles we move. I'm going to wrap now, but just in closing, really quickly, there's something about me whenever I'm talking to someone who's won an Oscar. There's just something. I got to ask you about the Oscar, but I wonder, did it, looking back now, because it's 8 years nearly now.
Yeah.
Does it change things? Like Robin Williams famously said, it's great, it holds the mail and then you move on. But I wonder when you look back now, is it a before and after, or is it just something that's kind of integrated into everything else you do?
I mean, it happened so, you know, it happened very quickly, or like early in my career. So it's hard to say. So in one way, of course it meant the world because it's part of the beginning of you know, all the work that I've done since then.
Yeah.
So obviously it had an incredible impact in where I'm at now and how I work.
Super. Well, listen, thanks for taking the time and
of course.
Taking
no
best
worries.
Of luck in everything else you do. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
Look at this beauty.
Did you do it?
Oh.
And ask you, did they burn her?
What, the preacher woman? Oh. Hey, that's godless business.
Oh. He would never do anything without asking you first.
Oh, Kit. What's this woman to you? She was a radical. She deserted her husband, her children. She was a fanatic, preaching...
Her death is on your soul.
A clip there from Firebrand, which tells the story of Catherine Parr, the last and surviving wife of King Henry VIII. It's in cinemas from Friday, the 6th of September. And you heard me there talking to Oscar winner Alicia Vikander about Firebrand. And as I say, it's in cinemas from Friday, September 6th. Up next, the week's new releases, including Elliot Page's Close to You. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. Going to turn now to the week's new cinema releases, and we're looking at the Elliot Page movie Close to You, and also an intriguing looking Icelandic movie called Touch. To make sense of all this, I'm joined by regular film critic and arts journalist, regular on this show. I mean, I don't know if he's regular himself. We can find out in due course. Chris Wasser, hello, how are you?
John, I'm well. How are you?
Good. Weird introduction, but listen, we'll battle on. So, Close to You, not to be mistaken with the Carpenter song, which I kind of like, I think most people do, is Elliot Page, a story about a man who's recently transitioned coming home. So straight away, without getting tabloidy about it, but this is clearly a very personal story to Elliot Page.
It is a very personal story to Elliot Page, who transitioned in 2020. Obviously, people before that would have known Elliot Page as Ellen Page, the Academy Award-nominated star of Juno, Whippish, Drew Barrymore's sports comedy. He was in Inception. He came out as a transgender man in 2020 and was on the cover of Time magazine. And for a while there, and probably still is, you know, one of the most famous transgender performers in the world, because, you know, he'd already had this huge platform as a film star and then as a TV star too with the Umbrella Academy, where I think I've never really been a huge fan of that series, but I think they actually worked Elliot's transition into the plot. But we actually haven't seen him on the screen in a film capacity since 2017. So this is the first that we've seen Elliot on the big screen, working with an acclaimed filmmaker in the form of Dominic Savage, who, you know, viewers might be familiar with the I Am series from Channel 4, and working with a story that is also about a transgender man going back to his family and kind of, you know, talking to them for the first time since his transition.
So where's the drama in this then? And I don't mean that, you know, I don't mean that to sound harsh, but what's going on other than him coming home and meeting people? I presume there's people who aren't okay with this, people who are struggling with it, he's struggling with it.
Yeah, there is a good family story here. So basically, Sam, Elliot Page's character, lives in Toronto. As I said, hasn't been home for 4 years, and it's his father's birthday. And he is just, you know, we're with him, you know, first thing in the morning. He's getting up, he's having his coffee, he's looking out the window, and he's quite, you know, stressed about this idea of seeing everyone, because it's, you know, it's supposed to be about his dad, but he knows that all of the family are going to be talking about him. So we don't know at this point whether or not the family is supportive. And it turns out when he gets there that they are, and they are trying very hard to, you know, gender him correctly, to, you know, ask the right questions. They're probably trying a little too hard, and that, you know, is understandably irking him, you know, from the moment he comes in, like they're kind of making a fuss over him. But we do, you know, see in time that, you know, mum and dad are actually really supportive. We have Peter Outerbridge as Sam's dad, who he does say all the right things, and he does want to talk to him about what it was like for Sam before he transitioned. And then we have Wendy Crewson as Sam's mum, who is just, you know, gets into an awful state every time, you know, she misgenders Sam. But there's always, in these kinds of stories, a rotten egg in the mix, and there's always someone who is, you know, going out of their way to cause trouble, to cause an argument. And it's one of the sisters' partners who is kind of being just, you know, intentionally provocative and just kind of, you know, letting everyone in the room know that he has a problem with this. And then on the other side of this family reunion of sorts, we have a potential love interest, because when Sam is on the way home to, you know, the family house, he meets an old friend and potentially an old girlfriend on the train. She is played by Hilary Back, playing this character, Catherine. And we're not really sure what the story was with the two of them, but there is obviously some sort of shared history, you know, some sort of unfinished business. And in between visiting his father and visiting, you know, the rest of the family, he also makes time to go visit Catherine, who actually has a husband and kids and works in a local cafe. Sam goes to visit Catherine and to kind of talk things out, and slowly but surely we kind of find out that there was something between them.
Okay, so this is a family drama, albeit dealing with the issue of transgenderism and people's difficulty, particularly maybe in families around that. So is it a good family drama?
There is a good family drama in here, I do think. I think it would have been a better family drama if Dominic Savage, the filmmaker behind it, had developed a proper screenplay. So the story for this was developed by Elliot and Dominic working together. But when it comes down to the dialogue, dialogue was mostly improvised for this, okay. And it really shows. And this is like a, this is a thing that Dominic does with his work, whether it's in the I Am television series, you know, he's worked with where he worked with Kate Winslet, and you know, whether it's in his past films working with Gemma Arterton, like dialogue has always been kind of, look, there are a few words on the page, but really go for it, and he'll just keep the cameras rolling, and there's sort of be a you know, a workshop element, and it's much more of a collaboration between the actor and the filmmaker. And in some cases and in some stories, that's, you know, and if the story is largely fictional, that's going to work. And we are dealing with the fictional story here, but we're also dealing with something very personal and something that, you know, is can be quite tricky. You know, you want to make sure that you're using the right language and that you're being, you know, you're giving this thoughtful, sympathetic portrayal. I just don't really think it works here because it sounds very amateurish at times, and some of the performers are not very good are coming up with things to say. And it gives this film that should have an awful lot of important, interesting things to say about an important, interesting matter. It makes it sound as though it's just, it's underdeveloped and it's very unfocused.
And does Elliot Page's character sound underdeveloped because he's the star of the show?
No, it's as though Elliot Page is in one film and everyone else is in another. Actually, Catherine Back the actress playing Catherine is actually very good too. But but the family side of things works because, you know, if dialogue is not really great, it's as though all the family members are kind of helping one another. But the love story, when it's just the two of them, is not that great. But Elliot is wonderful, commanding, capable, charismatic, always likable. It, you know, there is, it's great to see Elliot on the big screen again. Great to see him in a film capacity, but I just found the whole thing a little bit unfocused. You know, it's kind of, even towards the end, it kind of, when it's trying to explain that love story more, it just kind of, it kind of falters. So it's unfortunately, you know, it's admirable. And I didn't want to be the person saying bad things about this film, but it is quite awkward. I just wish there had been a proper screenplay in place.
Yeah, it sounds like they needed to write it a bit more. Not that I've seen it, though. So what would you say stars-wise for Close to You?
I mean, it's a 4-star performance in a 2-star film from Elliot Page. So great to have Elliot on the big screen again, but I think he deserved better.
A 4-star performance in a 2-star movie. So are you giving this movie 2 stars?
Yes, unfortunately.
Okay. That's fair enough. And just, I wonder in terms of, without giving a spoiler or anything like that, but does it reach a resolution, as in terms of this person coming home to discuss their new life and some people not being happy with it? Is it a satisfying, dramatic conclusion?
I wasn't quite satisfied. Without spoiling anything, it does sort of leave the family set up to focus more on the love story. And I was a little bit disappointed by that, only because there were other great actors in there, the mom and dad particularly, with Elliot. And I just liked watching them. So I was a little bit frustrated with that just being left.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take a clip of Close to You.
I'm going home for my dad's birthday.
Oh my gosh!
I haven't gone back in close to 4 years.
Jeez. Bold. That's a bold move.
Is it?
Hey. Hi.
Can I get you a drink?
First impression with a brother. Yeah.
It is really nice to meet you.
I know, I'm just nothing but a disappointment to them.
You sort of took off, you've been gone.
You can come to Dad and I for, you know, anything if you need it. I'm really okay. In so many ways I am, for the first time. I just still think of you as my little girl.
That is a clip from Close to You, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 30th of August. Chris raved more or less about Elliot Page's performance, which he gave 4 stars to, but the film overall is somewhat underwritten and he gives it 2 stars. Now, something very different is the new movie by the very hard to pronounce Baltasar Kormákur, his movie Touch. What's going on here, Chris?
Touch is a very different film than we're used to from Baltasar Kormákur, because Baltasar Kormákur has given us action movies like Two Guns, you know, adventure movies like Adrift, something epic like Everest. This is a hell of a lot smaller, and it tells the story of an aging Icelandic widower named Kristofer, played brilliantly by Egil Olafsson, who visits the doctor and is told that his memory, you know, he had his suspicions, but his memory is in fact fading. You know, his health has started to let him down. The doctor isn't quite sure how far along, you know, his condition is. You know, he's to have an MRI, but he does sit down with him and say, if you have any unfinished business, if there are any unresolved matters, go and fix them. And this is all on the eve of the pandemic too. So it's worrying times for Christopher, and he realizes that he might not have long to do something that he's wanted to do for a while, which is to get on a plane and go and find the one that got away. And I'm saying this even as the character is, you know, he's shown to be a witherer. Like, you know, he did have a life, you know, a happy life with someone, but there was someone else in his past. So he gets on a plane and he flies to London first and then later Japan. And at the same time, we see the story unfold 50, 51 years before that, where in 1969, he was a student at the London School of Economics. He dropped out to get a job in a Japanese restaurant, despite the fact that he couldn't cook at all. He starts out as a dishwasher. And there he falls in love with the owner's daughter, and she falls in love with him too, Miko. And we see their relationship blossom, but of course we know at the same time something is going to go wrong here. So it's for us to kind of, you know, chase that story, find out what went wrong, and then also find out if Christopher gets to actually find her in the present. And as I say, the pandemic is just starting while all of this is unfolding.
Okay. I mean, that sounds not that unusual a movie, but and certainly a strange choice for Baltazar, given what he's done before. So is this a successful story?
It really is, yeah. And it was only afterwards, John, that I learned that it's actually based on a novel. And the novelist is adapting his own work here. It's a chap named Ólafur Jóhann Ólafsson, who is a popular Icelandic writer. But also, get this, he was the one-time chief at Sony and was involved in the creation and the launch of the PlayStation. And I was talking to a friend of mine after watching this film who'd also seen it, and we were saying that, how do you get to a point in life where you're writing successful novels and you're also involved in the creation of groundbreaking video game technology?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very, you know, that's a hard working person right there.
Absolutely.
This is a gorgeous piece of work. It really is. And it's like, if the story by itself just works, you know, it's this epic romantic saga that's funny and endearing and poignant and powerful. And there is a lot more to it than meets the eye too, because Miko, played by Japanese actress and singer Koki, her story, as you know, her families are survivors of the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. So it goes an awful lot into their background and the reasons why they came to London and what they left behind. And it goes an awful lot, it goes an awful lot into this idea of the world is changing so rapidly around Christopher, you know, and he has his own problems, but he needs to push that all aside. He's just pretending almost that this, you know, life-altering thing for the rest of us is not happening, because he's in the middle of his own life-altering thing. Like, it's very effective. And it was only afterwards that I learned that actually the actor, Egil Olsson, he'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's shortly before they started filming. So there's an awful lot going on in here, John. You know, it is. Yeah. It's a lovely performance. It's quite novelistic. It's beautifully plotted. I had an awful lot of time for this.
And we were talking about, in close to you, you know, satisfying conclusions, and we don't want to give any spoilers, but this story of, you know, the one who got away and then tracking them down. And I won't ask, do they get together or anything like that? But again, the same question, is it a satisfying conclusion?
I found it to be a satisfying conclusion, a desperately sad conclusion.
Okay.
it was very satisfactory.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. Touch. And this is in cinemas again from today, this is in cinemas from the 30th of August, this Friday. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Touch?
I think I'm tempted to go the whole five. I mean, it's a beautiful performance. It's that, you know, we've seen that one that got away story done before. And we've seen, unfortunately, too many kind of COVID stories already on the big screen. I'm not mad about, you know, using such very recent history in terms of story making for cinema, but it's done beautifully and brilliantly. It's not a COVID film that just happens to be happening in the background. I'm going to go with five. It's a beautiful piece of work.
Wow, you haven't gone five in a while. I'm really intrigued by that. So that is Touch, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 30th of August. And Chris Wasser gave it a whopping five. You better get on it, people. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks a million, John.
Chris Wasser there, giving a whopping five stars to Touch. And before that, he was talking about Close to You, both of which are in cinemas from this Friday. And if you're listening on the radio, you can go see them in the cinema this very evening for £5, so it's not too late. Up next, the creepy new Irish horror movie Oddity that won the Audience Award at South by Southwest.
Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, opening this weekend is a very unusual and a pretty thrilling horror movie called Oddity. Following a brutal crime where Danny is murdered in a remote country house, a grieving woman attempts to discover what really happened to her sister. Her sister in question is Darcy, who is blind and runs a strange curiosity shop that sells kind of unusual antique keepsakes. A year later, her bereaved husband, Ted, is visiting her sister Darcy. Darcy has a strange talent for something called psychometry, an ability to connect with people through touching personal objects. Ted, that's the widow, has a present for her, a false eye of the man who was outside the house, it transpired, the night his wife died. It turns out he's also a doctor in a psychiatric hospital, and our old friend, Steve Wall, plays an unusual orderly. This is a very strange and deeply creepy movie. I've watched plenty of movies, as I've told you about many weeks, and I genuinely don't get scared anymore, but I hopped out of my skin at one point. Oddity is going gangbusters since it won the Audience Award at South by Southwest. High praise indeed. It was all directed and written by Damien McCarthy. I should say it was all filmed in Cork, which is an important part of Damien's story, and I'm delighted to say Damien joins me, I'm assuming, from the same Cork right now. Hello, Damien.
Hi, John. How are you doing? Yeah, I'm down in Cork at the moment. Great talk.
Where else would you be?
I know, yeah. And well done on the synopsis. It's really good. I'm glad that you did it and not me. I'm very bad at pitching my films, but you summarized it really well.
Excellent. Well, I kind of did that off the top of my head. And I say that with no trace of, yeah, am I great? But it was just, it's fresh in my mind because I only saw it a few days ago. Let me start at the beginning. There's something you do, and I hope it's not a spoiler, but there's a very dramatic, creepy opening, and we don't see the intro to the movie or in the This Is Oddity. I counted it to about 11 minutes in. You're told what the movie is. I thought that was very clever. You don't see that often. What was the rationale behind that?
I think it's just almost like having that kind of cold opening or that prologue to horror movies before the title card appears. It's just a way to get people hooked. It's that thing of like, okay, like it's that inciting incident, I guess. It's that thing of like, we haven't even seen the title of the film yet, and already you have that hook for the story, which is with Oddity, that this guy trying to talk his way into this woman's house late at night. It's just kind of an editing technique, I guess, to settle people in.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned that Caroline Bracken plays both sisters in it, and it occurs to me that the film is, but you tell me, is saying something about duality, maybe. So you have this actress playing both people, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but you also have characters, and we're really not sure if they're good or they're bad. Caroline, when she's playing Danny, is blind, but there was times I wasn't sure she was blind, and that's no disrespect to her performance, quite the opposite. So was that theme in your head, or is that one of the themes of it, you know, the yin and the yang, the duality of being, if that's not too philosophical a notion?
No, it is. It's a good observation, because, I mean, Carolyn Bracken is playing, she's playing twin sisters. And I guess one idea with that was to keep the running time down, to keep the film quite fast paced. There's never a scene where the two of them, you know, they don't have any scenes together. Like, you know, the two characters never share a scene. So you're trying to figure out a way to connect these characters quickly, almost off screen. So it's just kind of a thing in script writing to make them twin sisters. And if one loses the other, it's obviously going to have a great impact on the other. And they're both very different characters, and one's very, you know, laid back and relaxed. And then, of course, the other is dealing with the occult, and she's had health issues, and she's something of an unreliable narrator in some ways. But very much, I think all of the characters in it, they appear as one thing, but there's very much something going on behind that. Everybody from Steve Wall's character, who's this very menacing, threatening orderly, and clearly then he's got all this trauma and trauma in his past that's kind of made him the monster that he is. And there's, you know, there's a few archetypes in it. Like you could have that kind of, his new girlfriend could just be seen as this empty, you know, pharmaceutical sales rep who's very about appearances and all this kind of thing. But I kind of find that with her character, there's a lot more to her than that as well. So, I don't think it's just Carlin that seems to be playing two parts in a way. They all have something to hide.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what I mentioned. I was too clumsy in my description of it, that everyone is kind of a dual character in some ways. But maybe, you know, as Carl Jung would say, that's all life. And I should mention, because you alluded to her, Ted has taken up with a new lady, as we might say. And she does appear very, you know, one dimensional at the start, but there is so much more to her. Tell me this. I mentioned the shop that Danny's character owns and runs with all these unusual, slightly occultish keepsakes. I gather from what I read, you own some of those. They are your own private prop collection.
I do. I guess it comes from years of making short films, making no budget short films. I'd made one feature before Oddity. It's just this thing I've always had, going around to, you know, car boot sales. If I'm traveling, I'll always go to whatever street market is there and just picking up these oddities as such that they just make interesting props in movies. Like even at the back of Carlin's shop, she has this room that's full of haunted items. I mean, a lot of those items have been in short films I've made or just things I have around me in the office, you know, waiting for their own place in a film. It's just a kind of an odd hobby, I guess, collecting this stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, I mentioned jumping out of my skin at one point. And as I was alluding to, you know, I've seen plenty of horrors and I don't scare easy anymore. You know, having three children, you've seen it all. But there is this, and I don't want to give a spoiler, but there is a scene in a tent and I jumped. I really did. And it's so brilliantly done. And there's no real special effects. And I won't say any more, but a scene like that, do you discover it as you're in the process, or did you have that in your head? I'm going to give these people the willies with this.
That's great. Well, I'm glad that caught you out. Yeah, I think it's just all about building up that suspense. You know, it's like you can startle anybody in a film. You know, they can open up the cupboard and a cat can jump out, but it's not really earned. It's more startling than suspenseful. So I'd always kind of know where the scare is going to come from, like where that release is going to be. And then for me, it's about when I'm storyboarding the film, just working backwards to see how I can drag out that tension and kind of misdirect and maybe make the audience believe, well, it's going to come from the right, but then it's going to, you know, you catch them out then and make it come from the left. Little things like this. And that's just from years of watching horror films too and seeing, okay, let's see if this film can scare me. And I'm quite hard to catch out now with horror as well. So if I'll watch it, I'll really pay attention to like, okay, why didn't this scare me? Like, where did this and kind of what would I have done to have made this work? Or if I do get caught out and I do see, that's really, you know, the mechanics of that scare really well done and it really built up to that release. I'll really pay attention to that as well. But very much in the storyboarding. And then obviously when you get on, you know, you get onto the set with your crew and your cast, and you start, you know, trying to milk these things to really, you know, build up that suspense to the release.
Yeah. Well, I think young filmmakers listening should take note. You have to earn the scare. I think that's a very good way to put it. And in that one, and in lots of other points in the movie, you certainly do. Tell me this, Damien. I'm grateful to Esther McCarthy of The Examiner in her piece about you brought this to my attention. But you've an interesting background in that you place a lot of your early love of cinema back to working in your dad's electrical shop, who also sold videos and DVDs. Is that right?
That's right. It was in the mid 80s to the early 90s. They had a VHS rental shop. So, you know, to just be every day after school, you go into the shop, you know, surrounded by posters and reading the cover art and, or, you know, reading the backs of these boxes as when you're small. And it just kind of, I guess it just, you know, sparked off ideas and started my imagination that way. And I guess I had that opportunity too, being able to rewatch films, you know, again and again, that maybe you take it for granted now, but I guess back in the 80s, you were kind of renting a film and back the next day, whereas I think I was getting in trouble a lot because any good films we had in the shop were usually at home. You know, so.
I presume then you probably, also like me, probably watched a few horror movies before you were meant to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't think anything was really off limits when I was small. I was thinking about this the other day. I was talking to somebody, and I think the only thing that it was ever maybe off limits was, I think The Exorcist was the only thing that that was the only film I could think of that I wasn't allowed to watch. But I think everything right. else, like, you know, work away.
Yeah. Well, listen, all those horror influences are evident in your new movie, your full feature, Oddity. Tell me this, just in closing, I mentioned South by Southwest and winning the Audience Award. That's been a game changer, I'm sensing. Is it? Because, I mean, I've never been, but, you know, it's up there now with, you know, Venice and all the other ones.
It really was, because I'd made one film before this, and it was Caveat, and it was a micro budget film that took years to make, and that developed a nice cult following, and it got me my agents, and it led to Oddity, and I thought that Oddity would just be like a slightly bigger film, but once we got accepted to South by Southwest, that was very exciting. But then when I actually got to the festival, I knew the festival was a big deal, but I had no idea. I had no idea, like, how, just the amount of industry people that attended, how seriously people take the festival. And then when we won the Audience Award, yeah, it really has really opened a lot of doors. And I really do see the importance of that festival now. I was always a fan of it from afar, but it was it really changed things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, I hope those doors stay open. Tell me just finally, you know, there are certain people who will listen to this and go, oh, horror, I'm not into it. And I wonder, and it's not you to convince them, but I wonder, when you come up against that, have you any way to, how do you encourage people to give horror a go? Because I know lots of people, including my dear darling wife, who'll say, oh, it's a horror, I'm not going to watch it with you. Is there any way you can encourage those people to give horror another go? Because it seems to me that horror now is not horror the way it used to be. Like, even a movie like yours, it's no longer just about scaring people. There's so much more going on, and some people argue the most interesting storytelling is now happening in horror. So I'm wondering how you get people into the horror tent who aren't in it.
Yeah, I think one of the surprising things with this is, we'll say, when you're near the end of an edit on a film, you take it to a test audience just to see how the film's doing, if people can follow the story, if there's anything they can that you could improve on. This would be just a very impartial, you know, crowd from the street that volunteered to come in. What was nice about that is a lot of people that went to see the film, once it finished and you have a bit of a Q&A, they're saying, well, I usually wouldn't like horror films, or I wouldn't ever go along to a horror film. But they said, I really liked that, because they said the characters were interesting and there was a bit of, you know, dark comedy in it. And which was really good for me to hear that this might actually get these people, into the horror genre, because it is, you know, the storytelling that happens in it is great. I think as a horror filmmaker as well myself, I'd have no interest in ever disturbing anybody or disgusting anybody with the films I'd make. I mean, ultimately, you're trying to entertain and, you know, make it exciting and make it suspenseful. But then when it's finished, you know, you'd hope that people will come back and watch the film again. And I think you'll only do that if it is entertaining and it has something of value, as opposed to just being very, you know, downbeat or, you know, too violent. And I think, you know, from the reaction I've seen with audiences watching Oddity, you know, we've been successful in doing that. We've been, you know, we've made an entertaining film, hopefully, you know, that people will go back and watch a second time. And I've seen lots of horror films that are absolutely brilliant, but they're kind of a one-time watch. It's like, that film is so heavy, or it's so disturbing, or it's so violent. It's brilliant, but I'll never go back and watch it again. I don't think I'd ever like to make a film like that. I'd rather make something that, you know, has a few scares, has a few laughs, and on second viewing, people will get something else from it. So that would kind of be my hope with just films I'd make in general.
Sure, sure. Well, listen, Oddity is in cinemas from Friday, the 30th of August, genuinely creeping and entertaining. I've been talking to its director and writer, Damien McCarthy. Damien, thanks a million.
Thanks very much, John.
Damien McCarthy there talking to me about his creepy new horror movie, Oddity, which is in cinemas, select cinemas, from this Friday. That's the 30th of August, so you can go see it now. And if you're listening on the radio this Saturday, the 31st of August, you can see it for £5 in cinemas, because it's National Cinema Day, which I'm very pleased about. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, Michael Keaton and Willem Dafoe talking to me about Beetlejuice. So more of that next week. In the meantime, I just want to thank Stephen Daunt and Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show this week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll simply remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all next week.
The Capital Ideas podcast now features a series hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover what differentiates their investment approach, what learnings have shifted their career trajectories, and how do they find their next great idea? Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.